AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
On this week's Empire Podcast, we get our washboard tasty abs out, steady Helen, and discuss Magic Mike. We seek the end of the world as we know it with Keira Knightley and Steve Carell, but we feel fine. Bobcat Goldthwaite pops in to say God bless America, and we talk about the sheer majesty of Total Recall. No, not that one. The other one. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and you're listening to the Empire Podcast, the only film podcast that leads an exciting double life. By day, we're a film podcast. By night, we don tights and a mask and cruise the streets of London. Fighting crime? Sure. Why not? Let's stick to that. Anyway, let's welcome three Empire writers without whom I wouldn't be able to say, let's welcome three Empire writers. I always start by introducing Empire's Queen Geek, the Prime Minister of Nerds, the Supreme Chancellor of Fanboys, Helen O'Hara, and why break from tradition now? Hello, Helen.
Hello. That's a lot of titles that I'm going to have to now...
You've been promoted.
Live up to, yes.
Think of the pay rise.
Woohoo!
You get a lot more money being the Supreme Chancellor of Fanboys.
That sounds great.
This is awesome, isn't it? Okay. All right. A man who spent so much time shadowing Chris Nolan for our Dark Knight Rises coverage that Emma Thomas began to ask questions, but it was all perfectly innocent, honest. Please welcome to the pod booth, Dan Jolan Nolan. How are you, Dan?
Hello.
Was that your Batman voice?
Was that your Chris Nolan impression? It was terrible.
Yes.
Do people know, do you think, that Emma Thomas is Chris Nolan's partner?
If they don't, they do now.
Okay.
Yes. Producing partner and partner in love.
Ooh.
Aww. Next up, a man whose love of art house cinema is so indelible, he has subtitles tattooed on his chin. What have you got this week, Phil?
I've got the entire script of The Artist on my face, Chris.
Including storyboards. I quite like that. Yeah,
storyboarding on my neck.
Storyboards in your eyelids.
It just makes me sound really weird, like some kind of middle class Maori. Yeah, let's move on.
That was, of course, Phil Dissimlin. And before we get on the tricky business of telling Hollywood how to do their jobs, let's hear from you guys on the other side of the booth. Some talking points this week, people. At Stevie Man Muppet asks, why can't Spider-Man keep his identity a secret? He's always showing off with no mask on, the fool.
Yeah, I thought he kept taking his mask off for no reason in this film. I kept sort of mentally kind of cringing until he put it back on. I was really worried for him.
Why? Just in case something hit him in the face or someone saw him? Or
see him. And, you know, then where would he be?
The thing I was worried about in that film was when he gets his powers on the subway train and he's just gallivanting around being all spidery on the subway, and, you know, there's cameras and stuff. And surely
nobody puts it together.
The cops are stupid.
Pretty much.
They're stupid in this film.
Well, they also ignored the lizard on the bridge in favour of the small guy in the blue and red costume, so hey.
It's true, though. It's a good point, because...
The lizard on the bridge.
Kick-Ass made a thing of, you know, the we're in the YouTube age now and everybody's got camera phones. And how does a superhero work in that environment?
Yeah, precisely.
No one else has decided to run with that idea.
You also have to remember that people in comic book movies are just overwhelmingly stupid. I mean, no one's put the Batman Bruce Wayne thing together, apart from obviously
that guy.
Mr. Reese.
There was that guy. He worked it all out.
In The Dark Knight. He did. And then Morgan Freeman stared him down.
Yeah.
Lois Lane is the worst investigative journalist in the history of mankind and Kryptonkind. It's ridiculous.
I think the idea is if you've paid, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars for some really gorgeous person to appear in your movie, I guess you should get your money's worth. That said, you know, the new Judge Dredd movie, we've got the very gorgeous Carl Urban keeping his hat on the whole time, so it can be done. And I think sometimes, you know, we still see Andrew Garfield in the movie. I just think he could have maybe kept his mask on a little bit more.
And speaking of Batman as well, the Nolan Batmans, you know, there hasn't been a sequence where Batman suddenly feels an urge to rip off his mask at the end of Batman Begins.
No, they're very specific about that. Yeah, they're actually very specific about that, in the sense that Batman is always Batman. There's no kind of half and half, you know, it's Bruce Wayne's head, Batman's body kind of thing. I don't think there's a single scene, although there may be, I'm just going by memory here, I don't think there's a single scene, yes, in either of the previous two films where he walks around wearing the suit without the cowl, although you see him obviously in his armour early in Batman Begins, and you don't actually see him as Batman until an hour in, which is a good way of getting around that. But they split the time quite evenly between Bruce Wayne and Batman in the Nolan movies.
But I just seem to remember that in the Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher films, there seemed to be always some sort of flimsy excuse at the end. And same with the Spider-Man movies, the Raimi Spider-Man movies. There always seemed to be a flimsy excuse for him to take off his mask. Oh, my mask's on fire. Oh, we've got to take it off. Hello, I'm Tobey Maguire, everyone. Hey. You know, so...
Kudos to David Prowse, who I think his physical performance as Darth Vader is massively underrated. Everyone's like James Earl Jones, and you know, he got dubbed over. But, you know, that first moment when Darth Vader walks in, puts his hands on his hips and looks a bit disappointed, like a kind of slightly annoyed headmaster. Every child knows exactly who he is, that he's the bad guy, that he's the leader of the bad guys, and that you don't mess with him. David Prowse nailed that physical performance.
Absolutely, he certainly did. And going back to Dredd, Helen, you mentioned Carl Urban. I mean, you know, and actor's vanity. Stallone, you know, famously said, you know, I can't do a whole film with a mask on. People want to see me. They want to see my face. But Carl Urban, no, none of that.
And personally, I would rather see Carl Urban's face than Sylvester Stallone's. And yet, I'm still on board with his decision to keep the mask on.
How do you feel about just a little bit of the chin?
Well, it's a nice chin.
So there you go, Stephen Man Muppet. I think we've solved that one. And of course, you know, we may not answer that specific question on our special Spider-Man spoiler podcast, but we damn near answer everything else. So download it now or suffer the consequences.
Consequences?
There are no consequences. Okay. You can do whatever you want, honestly. At Grudge Reinhold, who has one of the best Twitter names I've heard recently, asks, what's a favourite film that you like that everyone else dislikes? For me, it's Godzilla 98. I think it means the year, not the name, number of the film, but yeah. Do you have one?
I like a lot of films that any sensible person would consider, you know, by any rational standard, bad. Sure.
Such as?
Well, I have a medical condition that causes me to watch Sister Act every time it's on TV.
Oh, I've heard about that.
Yeah, it's really pretty debilitating. That would probably be one. I don't want to watch it. I just can't quite turn the channel when it's on.
Oh, that's terrible. What about Sister Act 2?
Sister Act 2 as well. Yeah, totally. Although you've kind of got to skip to the end there, because the bit at the end is quite good with
the
ridiculous rap song with the dungarees. Remember about God? It's brilliant.
I think I've blocked this out of my memory. I'll be honest. Dan, you were racking your brains about this earlier on.
Yeah, I was. I'm going to actually settle on Alien 3.
Okay.
I actually once told Fincher, David Fincher, this. I said, I actually like Alien 3.
Did you say it in those terms?
Yeah, I do.
Hey, David Fincher.
I do.
I actually like one of your films.
Fincher, yeah. And he told me off.
Why?
He had a go at me. He was like, no, you're wrong. It's not a good movie. It's not what the series deserved.
Right.
You know, he was really, I thought, I'm going to tell him I like Alien 3, and he's going to be like, oh, hey, you're the guy, you like it, let's be friends. But no.
Let's go have dinner with Chris Nolan.
let's hang out. Let's be chums. Absolutely genuinely, it was the weekend it came out, it was opening weekend, went to see it at the, whatever it was, the Canon Cinema in Sidcup or whatever, and it blew me away. I mean, you know, I was vaguely aware that it had been a troubled production, but I can't remember how old
it
was.
Actually, teenager. Blew you away. Alien 3 blew
it
you away.
Absolutely. I just sat there and it was just like, oh my God, she's got one inside. Spoilers. She's got one inside her, and oh, she killed herself at the end. Whoa, you know, it blew my mind. Wow. And then bad review. And I'm like, what's going on here? Am I the only guy in the world? I was still evolving. Okay. Into the Dan Jolin that I am now.
All right, you were chestburster Dan.
I was,
or
what?
Were you chestburster Dan or facehugger Dan at that point? Or
I, having seen Prometheus, I couldn't tell you. I've no idea anymore.
Had you ingested any black goo?
Right, let's stop it there. Let's just draw a bell.
You share DNA, should we say?
Moving swiftly on. Phil,
I'm someone that thinks that there's no bad Michael Caine movie. So
there are.
I know. Well, I disagree. I'll watch any of them.
Disagree back.
I'll watch, which one? I'll watch Swarm 2 if there was one. Swarmier. I love The Eagle Has Landed. I don't think anyone says it's a bad film, but I don't know as much love for it, but I love it. And it's on TV every bank holiday. And this year there's been about 74 bank holidays, so I've watched it a lot.
Larry Hagman gets shot right in the head in that.
Yeah, I know.
That's what I remember.
Who shot JR?
Yeah, exactly. A German.
Maggie Simpson, wasn't it?
well, my love of crappy comedies that nobody likes leads me to probably either Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo, or, which is genuinely hilarious.
Don't make me he bitch manslap.
Oh, absolutely. It's just really, really quotable. There's this there's this wonderful thread throughout the film where Eddie Griffin keeps getting accused of, he keeps being implicated in incriminating situations where he's, you know, where people have died and he just happens upon them. But he happens upon them in quite a gay fashion. And so the news keeps reporting about this gay serial killer that's going around, and he keeps trying to, you know, untangle himself from this. And I just always remember this. There's one news report, it goes, in his gayest murder yet. just destroys me. Also, I have a very soft spot for Josie and the Pussycats.
Oh, well, no, there's like at least two or three good jokes in that.
Yeah.
The Backdoor Lovers song is amazing. It's absolutely incredible.
It's very, very good. The soundtrack's excellent. Who wouldn't fall in love with Rachel Lee Cook in that film? She's gorgeous. Little ray of sunshine.
You didn't fall in love with Rosario Dawson in that film?
Well, that was a given.
Oh, okay.
That was a given, but Rachel Lee
Cook. Was she jealous?
Who?
Rosario.
I don't know. We don't keep in touch anymore.
Okay.
Since the restraining order.
I know. She was so insistent.
Whilst we're on the subject, just very quickly, because this is a great topic and I think everyone's got films that they love that the world disagrees with them on, but apart from Happy Gilmore, are there any Adam Sandler films that love?
Oh, right, okay.
Punch Drunk Love.
Apart from
you mean
apart from the
apart from the really good ones.
You mean like a Happy Madison film rather than
a Happy Madison film season. Yeah, because I quite like the Zohan.
Yeah,
gotta be honest, that made me laugh quite a lot of times.
The thing about Adam Sandler films, apart from his recent movies like Grown Ups and Just Go With It and
Jack and Jill,
Last My Boy got an absolute kicking in the States, but I laughed quite a lot at it. There are some jokes there that are genuinely clever.
You got to think about Andy Sandler,
but people are prejudging. It's not Andy Sandberg, it was the Sandler stuff made me laugh. People are prejudging it based on Sandler and his track record, but if you actually go and see it with an open mind, and bear in mind I like You Speak a Low European Gigolo, there are some really genuinely clever jokes in there, and there's some really horrible crass ones, and there's sexist jokes and homophobic jokes and racist jokes. You ignore those and there's some really, really good ones. But I always think that there are genuinely funny moments usually in almost every single Adam Sandler film. Mr. Deeds is terrible, but
I watched Jack and Jill on the plane recently.
But
now, the one joke in that that's in any way acceptable.
The Pacino one?
No, it's the sight. Well, that's okay, but it's the sight of Johnny Depp wearing a Justin Bieber t-shirt. That's the joke, okay? That's the one joke. I've just spoiled that movie for you.
Like
I apologise.
The Dunkachino stuff and all the, you know, the bits where, you know, it was, she says to him, you know, I thought you'd have more than one Oscar, and he goes, surprisingly, no.
You'd think.
Yeah. That's good stuff. It's very self-aware stuff.
Okay, that one joke, but the rest of the Pacino stuff, bad.
I'm talking early Sandler. I'm talking like, I'm talking like, you know, Little Nicky, Mr. D.
Yeah, there's funny bits in those.
There's really funny bits. It's usually like one absolutely devastatingly funny joke in amongst this morass of crap. That was Adam Sandler.
That was fun.
There you go. What have we decided?
Everything.
Hooray! Well done. Okay. At N. Clo asks, what's the most you've ever spent on a collectible?
I think for me it would be, at Comic-Con a couple of years ago, I got some Pixar art prints, which were gorgeous. And the prettiest one was from Up, and it shows the balloon in the clouds and it's kind of sunset. And that was about $180.
Oh!
Yep.
That's why I didn't buy it. I just remember why I didn't buy it. Okay. That is a good one. Dan?
I bought this, it's an Inception poster, but it was one designed by, you know, by the Olimos kind of thing, that kind of an illustrator has come up with their own poster for Inception, which was really cool. And that was about 75 quid.
Wow, okay.
Very nice. It's kind of like
sounds good.
Heads as mazes, but there's heads inside heads inside heads. And the number of heads there are the number of levels of reality that there are in Inception. And in the centre is a little spinning top.
Very clever. Yeah. Is it all upside down? Have you hung it upside down?
Well, it's one head's the right way up, and then one's upside down, and one's the right way up, and one's up.
I got one similar actually last year for Mean Streets, which I did get framed. So that was quite expensive, but it's really cool.
Define expensive.
Well, the framing and the poster, I don't know, it's about 100 and something quid.
Yeah.
I guess. So it's kind of expensive, but it's beautiful. I love it. It's a candle, and it's just the man flickering as the wick. The wick? The flame.
Well, at Enclo added on her tweet that she was trying to justify spending 140 $5 on an Avengers collectible.
Do it.
Well.
Do it.
Do it. Do you think do it? Because
Hang on. Okay, I want you to, Chris, to reflect for a moment.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, you went to Comic-Con.
Yeah.
And you saw that Galactus.
Yeah.
And you loved it a lot.
I did.
But it was quite expensive.
Shut up, Dan.
And you didn't buy it.
David Fincher wanted to shut up.
And you are still talking about not having bought that Galactus.
It is one of the big regrets of my life. Shut up, Dan. Seriously.
Are you wishing the same fate on Enclave?
No, I'm not. I strongly urge you to. At Comic-Con, it was sold out. In fairness, I couldn't buy it then. But then, seriously, Dan, I will punch you in the face. If I had my 19-inch Galactus action figure here, I'd be able to reach across the desk and hit you with it. But I don't. I saw it in Forbidden Planet, because Empire, we work right next door to Forbidden Planet on Shaftesbury Avenue in London. I was in there like a year ago, and they had this 19-inch Galactus action figure that I'd missed at Comic-Con, and it was £75. And you know, I don't buy a lot of collectibles because I don't earn a lot of money, so therefore I don't have a lot of, you know, so I don't do that sort of stuff. But this called to me, and I spent a whole day umming and ahhing about it, and then at 6 o'clock I went, you know what, screw it, I'm going to go buy it, and someone had beat me to it by 10 minutes.
Yeah. So I think we've learned something here today.
I think we learned something valuable. What have we learned?
That was
then?
Almost Shakespeare.
The Helen's bought the Galactus.
I've learned. I mean, there's an important moral. You know, if you want a 19-inch eater of worlds to grace the foot of your bed,
when you say 19-inch, like a,
then
just,
you should
it sounds
just seize
tawdry.
The moment. Seize the moment.
It's like 50 Shades of Galactus. It just
Carpe
sounds,
Galactus.
Carpe Galactus. Absolutely. Brian Dugan of Manchester emails in to ask, when talking to people, or well, it doesn't ask, he says, when talking to people about film, I usually ask them if they like Harold and Maude. If the answer is they do not like it, then I can be quite certain I should not be talking to them. Do you have any films that you would use for social screening purposes? Oh, and do you like Harold and Maude?
Yes.
He does say he won't subscribe or listen to the podcast again if he said no. So obviously we're going to say yes. We do.
No,
and also my mum is
yes.
Maude. So yeah, I'm predisposed to like it. So there we go. Not in the film. She wasn't Maude in the film.
I was going to say.
No, but her name is Maude. Okay.
Okay, so. Moving on.
Sorted out. Dan. Do you have any films that you would use for social screen purposes? This reminds me of Quentin Tarantino when he famously said that he used to show Rio Bravo to prospective girlfriends, and if they didn't like it, he would just kick them to the curb.
Brazil. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'd say Brazil.
Have you done this before?
No.
Have you shown people a film, and then if they don't like it, you just hide them under your bed?
No, not to be honest, I've yet to show anyone that film who didn't like it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. I don't really have one. I mean, I used to take a little leaf out of Tarantino's book and show prospective girlfriends a Shawshank Redemption, because I think showing films Mel raping them is always good for getting people on side in a romantic context. What the hell
yeah,
was I thinking
maybe.
Of? But yeah,
yeah.
And if they didn't like it, but then who doesn't like the Shawshank Redemption?
Well, that's it. That's one of the things I've noticed. Like, if you look on dating websites, for example, everyone says they like the Shawshank Redemption. It doesn't narrow it down at all. I tend to not so much judge people on whether they like the films I like as make sure that they've had an opportunity to see the films that I like by sitting them down and making them watch things like The Princess Bride and His Girl Friday, and even in some cases there
Sister
are people
Act.
Out there who haven't seen Star Wars. It's appalling, but it's true.
Thanks to everyone who sent in questions for us this week. Sorry if we didn't get around to yours, but do keep trying. The best way to get in touch with us is via email, which is podcast@empireonline.com, or Twitter, where we're @EmpireMagazine. Do follow us if you like movie news and incredibly bad jokes. Oh, and do use the #EmpirePodcast to draw our attention. Do not, and I can't stress this enough, wait outside our offices and throw balls of scrunched up paper with questions written on them in blood at us. Digital is so much more civilized. You can also use the same methods to enter our weekly competition. Last week we offered two listeners a chance to win signed Killer Joe posters signed by the movie's director William Friedkin. The question was, name Gene Hackman's character in The French Connection, and the answer was, of course, Popeye Doyle. Some people actually gave his first name as well, which is Jimmy Popeye Doyle. Didn't necessarily help you, but your thoroughness is impressive. The winners are Gary Wallace and Robert Kelly. Congratulations to you both. Thanks, Dan. We should do that more often.
Applause.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if Dan has a cogent thought, we should applaud it.
Well, not that often then.
Yay!
I just had a cogent thought.
Well done, Dan. Give him a sweet. This week's prize, obviously the chance to win three amazing Genius of Hitchcock books produced by the BFI to tie in with their stunning Hitchcock season currently taking place down in the South Bank here in London. To stand a chance of winning, answer this week's ridiculously easy question, which is, what was Alfred Hitchcock's last film? There we go. Ooh. Simple.
Transformers the movie.
Give him a sweet. He's had another cogent thought. Send us your answers along with your name and postal address to the addresses I've just mentioned. Coming up, we're going to delve into the week's movie news. Lucky old week's movie news. Okay, now it's time for me to go full Hugh Edwards. Don't worry, I won't do the voice, and talk about the week's movie news. Helen, what's got you standing outside the fictional doors of 10 Downing Street of film this week? It's a bit tortured.
A little tortured. To be honest, it was quite a quiet news week, but the thing that got me most excited all week was the fact that Who Framed Roger Rabbit is coming out on Blu-ray.
Ooh.
Which is terrific news because it's a terrific film and it hasn't been on Blu-ray before. It took a very long time, I remember, to get to DVD as well. So hooray for high def.
Thanks Helen for that riveting news story.
Shut up.
Let's go live to Phil now, who's standing outside a dilapidated art house cinema somewhere in the former Yugoslavia. Phil.
Yes.
What's playing on the old black and white pathé newsreels there?
Raging Bull 2, we talked about a few weeks ago, with William Forsythe playing the older Jake LaMotta. That is in production, and we were quite... I think our conclusion talking here was that it's a bit... but it'll be probably, you know, if not straight to DVD, then pretty close to that, and won't really tarnish the legacy of that great film. MGM... think otherwise, and they've come forward and slapped a big old lawsuit down.
Really?
And they've named Jake LaMotta as the defendant. I think defendant Helen, you're a legal expert. Is defendant the right term, or claimant, or
defendant?
Defendant. Yeah, he's the one who has to defend himself from this sequel, which is they're claiming they want damages in an amount sufficient to punish Raging Bull 2's defendants and deter those who would knowingly seek to profit from similar actions. And I think what they mean by that is they are passing off on Martin Scorsese's masterpiece to make a kind of tawdry cash-in sequel. And I think their real problem is that it's called Raging Bull 2. If it was called something else, I don't think it would be an issue. They are claiming that Raging Bull 2 is publicly associating the sequel with the original and plainly intending to cause and create confusion in the marketplace. Now, again, I don't have great legal knowledge, but I think passing off is quite difficult to prove in this case, probably less so, but I honestly not sure quite how that's going to pan out.
But Helen, they have a point, don't they?
Yes, I think the name is the problem. If it was called, you know, Jake LaMotta, the continuing story, I don't think anyone would think twice about it. But if you're calling it Raging Bull 2, that's a slightly different matter.
This reminds me of the story from a couple of months ago. I don't think we covered in the podcast about this company. I can't remember their name, but effectively they've declared their intention to make Evil Dead 4. Without the cooperation of Sam Raimi, Robert Tappert, Bruce Campbell, or Renaissance Films, because they claim, and Helen, again, as our legal expert, you can probably back me up on this one, they claim that Sam Raimi gave an interview that's printed in an Evil Dead book, a making of Evil Dead book, where he basically says, Evil Dead 3, yeah, that's it, we're not going to do any more. So they claim that legally that means he's given up his right, and his company have given up the right to make any more Evil Dead films. Now, this despite the fact that Evil Dead Remake is currently in the works with Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell and Robert Tappert involved. They're also actively developing an Evil Dead 4 which will star Bruce Campbell as Ash. And obviously, Renaissance Films and Raimi are fighting this in the courts, but this other company are just kind of flicking the feeds at them and going, no, we're going to do it anyway.
Well, no, it's been a while since I studied copyright law. It's possible there have been developments, but that sounds to me like a complete pile of tosh.
It sounds like a bunch of chancers chancing around.
Yes, that would be, if anything, an understatement.
Legally, that's I can say that.
Legally,
much,
I think you can say that.
I always think that, you know, moviegoers are a bit more savvy than that, and they can sniff out a ropey kind of jobbing sequel.
I don't know if they can. I mean, I guess the fact that there are loads of DTV sequels to movies. I mean, I saw coming out very, very soon is SWAT 2 Firefight. I mean, honestly, who's watching this stuff? But people obviously do. They watch 8mm 2. They watch Stir of... There are Stir of Echo sequels. I mean...
Yeah. It's weird. I wasn't surprised to hear William Friedkin last week saying that he hadn't watched The Exorcist sequels.
I was, actually.
But I was surprised to see he hadn't seen The French Connection 2.
Yes, which is actually a really, really good
really,
film.
Really good, yeah.
And Exorcist 3 is really, really good. But, you know, hey-ho. I'm sure he has his reasons. And now it's time for Dan's new story. Dan, this week you're reporting from inside the walls of Chris Nolan's home, I believe.
Well, my new story, funnily enough, is about another superhero franchise, or franchises. This whole Marvel Secret Film business. It's been announced that Marvel Secret Film has moved from May 16th, 2014, to August the 1st, 2014.
Right.
Now, this rather seemingly innocuous fact has been interpreted as proving that, in fact, Marvel Secret Film, which was previously thought to be the Black Panther, but has been proven that it's not, apparently, mm-hmm. it's now going to be Guardians of the Galaxy. Guardians of the Galaxy is a bit of a tougher sell in terms of introducing it and getting people's heads around what it is. So they've pushed the date back, yeah. so they've got more time to explain
right,
what yeah. it is. Now, this is, in a way, a good point, because I know the Marvel Universe pretty well. I used to read the comic books.
Yeah.
And have still recently read some of the comic books. But I can honestly say I've no idea who the Guardians of the Galaxy are.
Well, this is the thing. I actually used to read Guardians of the Galaxy. They were, you know, back in the, I think it was the 1990s, when Marvel right. was just relaunching virtually every title they could think of, from Guardians of the Galaxy to Silver Sable, and they used to bring out these grand issue ones with the, like, the silver covers and the colourful covers that you thought, you know, oh, if I buy this now, it'll be worth £10,000 by the time I'm 40. I don't think it's going that way at all. But and I used to read Guardians of the Galaxy, and I can't remember a single thing about it. Apart from one of the guys in the team, it's a galactic superhero team.
Yeah, I mean, I've written it.
Purple with a mohawk. That's all I remember about
it. It's Adam Warlock, right?
Oh yeah, Drax, I know who that is.
Drax the Destroyer.
I know Drax the Destroyer.
Gamora.
Wasn't that a film?
Yeah, Gamora.
Yeah,
yeah. Quasar.
Quasar. Yeah. Yeah.
Now Nova, I know, because Nova was a Herald of Galactus. Yeah. Your favourite, and Rocket Raccoon.
I think, is this a new, because there's a new Guardians of the Galaxy team, I think.
Is it?
This isn't the Guardians of the Galaxy team that right. I was okay. reading.
You sure this isn't the writing team, Dan?
Yeah. You know, I've just written these down. Now, Adam Warlock vaguely rings a bell, as does Drax the Destroyer, but...
Well, Adam Warlock certainly brings it into the whole Thanos world.
Right, okay.
They're establishing with the Avengers too. And clearly, Marvel are taking the success of that movie and Thor, which introduced the idea of aliens and into the Marvel Universe, as a sign that audiences are going to be, I guess, receptive to this sort of stuff, to the more out there...
But after the Green Lantern, why would they go there?
It's a curious one, but I've got much more faith in Marvel than I do in, you know, random people who don't really know what they're doing.
Okay,
picking up Green Lantern.
Is there anything in this? Because as I stalk Christopher Nolan, you stalk Kevin Feige.
With no, there's no. I haven't asked my Marvel sources about this. Perhaps I should with my news hat on, but they'll probably just.
Yeah, so it's a weird one.
They'll probably
it's
just say.
I want secret film to be Secret Wars.
Now that would be awesome.
That's like the next step up from Avengers, isn't it?
That would be amazing. But then you'd have to have Spider-Man in there and Fantastic Four and stuff and X-Men. And, oh God, it'd be so good.
Yeah,
it'd be so good.
Brilliant. And all the baddies, including Galactus.
Yes, that'd be amazing. And the lizards in there as well.
Yeah, and the bit where Doctor Doom gets all the power of Galactus is just the best.
And we set up Spider-Man 2 as well, because that's where he gets his symbiote costume.
Indeed.
If you haven't read Secret Wars, by the way, it's this cracking limited edition from the 80s, where a lot of Marvel heroes and villains are transported to a patchwork planet made by this hugely powerful entity called the Beyonder, and then they just fight for 12 issues, and Doctor Doom has evil plans to steal the Beyonder's power, and it all kicks off. And it also has my favourite Hulk moment of all time. In Secret Wars, when Molecule Man, whose powers are realized to their full potential in Secret Wars, and this is the geekiest thing we've ever done in this podcast. Anyway, screw it. We're moving on. Molecule Man has his powers are fully realized by Doctor Doom, because he can control molecules, which means effectively he's one of the most powerful people in the universe. And so the heroes are miles away, and Molecule Man picks up a mountain range using nothing but the power of molecules. And maybe even the Higgs boson.
Probably
the Higgs boson. And drops them on the heroes. And that's a cliffhanger at the end of the issue. And you go, no, the heroes have been squashed flat. But they haven't been. Because the strong superheroes kind of catch the mountains in the next issue. But the Hulk, who at this point is Bruce Banner inside the Hulk's
body. Gave him his mind.
Because he slowly progresses into the Savage Hulk. Yeah. But he's holding the mountain range, billions of tons of rock on his back, and bitching and moaning about it because it's really heavy. And it's just my favourite moment. Anytime anyone says, who's the strongest one there is? I go, Hulk, because he carried a mountain range on his back.
He has universal strength.
This is from your Marvel.
It's from the Marvel Superheroes role-playing game. I just made it geekier.
Just when you thought we couldn't get any worse.
See, the Thing only has monstrous strength, but the Hulk has unearthly strength.
I never understood why the Thing and the Hulk would... Why the Thing keeps antagonizing the Hulk. Because the thing just can't hold a candle to Hulk. No. I mean, it's just daft.
Yeah.
Stupid, man.
Yep.
But the Guardians of the Galaxy weren't those cards, I'm sure. But Helen, what do you think about this? Do you think Guardians of the Galaxy might work? It's a bit of a tough sell, isn't it?
It's a tougher sell, but then, you know, I think what Marvel have shown they can do really well is to find a way to, you know, make unlikely characters work. Who would have thought that Thor could work in the same universe as Iron Man, you know, sort of a very grounded superhero, and then this godlike alien from another planet, and they kind of find a way to do that. So I'm hopeful that by figuring out what works about the comics, which is what they've done so far, and making that happen on screen, that they can make this happen. But certainly, yeah, it's another step up for them in terms of difficulty.
Absolutely, and it sounds like it could be huge as well. But if it does happen, what I would like to see, I wouldn't like to see Earth or any connection with humans. I'd like to just see this be a galactic superhero team fighting out there, and maybe somehow they go to Asgard or something like that. But I wouldn't want to see the usual, you know, because Green Lantern had this great universe and then just ends up with him on Earth running around driving a motorbike and stuff, and it's a little bit limited in scope and imagination. So it'd be good to do that. But also, maybe by moving from May to August, they've opened up another slot for something in May, because there's always this talk of Edgar Wright's Ant-Man, for which test footage is being shot.
Right.
So it might be that as well.
Unless that's the secret film.
That could be the secret film.
Mm. And Guardians of the Galaxy business is all just...
We shall know, hopefully this time next week, at Comic-Con in San Diego. Bobcat Goldthwaite is best known to some as a scabrous, no-fear comedian, and best known to most as the screeching criminal-turned-cop said in three of the Police Academy movies. But recently, he's turned his hand to writing and directing excellent pitch-black comedies that expose the moral hypocrisies of American society, from Sleeping Dog's Lie to World's Greatest Dad. He's at it again with God Bless America, a hyper-violent satire starring Joel Murray, yes, one of Bill's brothers, as an ordinary Joe who, fed up with the crass commercialization and unfeeling nature of American society, decides to go on a killing spree with 16-year-old girl, because that always solves problems. Goldthwaite came in earlier this week to talk about his frequently very funny movie, and here are some of the highlights. He was talking to me and Ali Plum. So we're in the Empire Bot booth with Bobcat Goldthwaite, the director of God Bless America, and when I watched this film, I thought, this is a movie that I'm sure the Founding Fathers would have been horrified to see.
Well, or it would be principles that they tried to put in place, and they'd be happy to see
just
that.
Just crumbled.
Yeah. No. They'd be happy to see that freedom of expression still existed.
Yeah.
So,
true.
So, and then everything else they probably would have been mad at.
Yeah, just in the society that they forged.
Yeah, but you know, these guys were, you know... They still had their slaves and whores. I mean, they weren't.
This is true.
How upright were they?
Of virtue.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. So, where did this movie come from for you? Because I believe it was when you were channel surfing.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's funny. People sometimes will say, "Why doesn't Frank just turn off the TV?" And it's like, because you can't escape this stuff. I mean, like, there's no reason I should know anything about Kim Kardashian's wedding or if she's divorced, but I still had to, you know, hear about it. And I don't know. I was about to say there's no reason I knew about that dumb whore's wedding, but then I realize I'm the problem when I say that. You know, yeah. I'm just as shocking as the people that get shot in the movie. You know, or faux shocking. You know, that's something that really drives me crazy. And I don't think there's as much of that in the UK as there is in the States.
It's creeping over here.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, the faux outrageousness. I mean, I'm sure. That, I mean, there's a lot of the crap television shows. They're all the same, and we rip each other's shows off.
Yeah.
But like the wacky morning aggressive DJs or the conservative DJs that just spew this stuff every day, so you can have your opinions reaffirmed, or it's not shocking. It's actually pretty predictable. But that you guys for some reason dodged that bullet to an extent. It seems like
I think part of that might come from the fact we have a national broadcaster. And the BBC is obviously funded by the taxpayer, and it's, you know, it's kind of funded by the government in a way. So we've never really quite gone down that path, but there are talk radio shows that are springing up over here now.
Yeah, what about like podcasts? I mean, aren't they the equivalent of...
I've never looked them up, but I'm sure they're there. I'm sure that
this one isn't. This one is not. This, yeah, we don't.
This,
the one,
this one's huge.
Oh, it's massive.
First of all, massive. This is going to reinvent me. Bobscatch Goldfarb takes over the UK. That's good to know. That's well, great to know.
That's what we're aiming for. But
that I sound like I'm sucking up to you, but you know that is the exciting thing about podcasts too. You're talking to the people that would actually see the movie versus me going on, you know, Taint and Teabag, as it's implied in the movie. It's called Taint and Jeff, but and you go on and you know, hey, it's Tuesday, you know. So as a comedian, I've done a million of those shows, but we should explain the movie a little bit to folks who aren't aware of it, or will you do that?
We will do it in the podcast.
We'll build up to it. Well, you don't need my you want to hear my explanation?
All right.
So it's a movie about a guy who's a farmer, and his aunt and uncle are killed by stormtroopers. No, it's a movie. It sounds good. Yeah, yeah. It'll never fly.
When you burn it down to lose, you know, those basic elements.
Yeah, that's all that is. It's really Dorothy trying to get home, kind of. But no, it's a movie about a guy who's suicidal and he's about to commit suicide, and then he's watching a show like My Super Sweet 16, and then instead of committing suicide, he decides to drive 400 miles and shoot that girl in the face.
Yeah.
And then and he meets up with a young gal who says, "Did you kill Chloe?" It's her classmate, and Frank doesn't say anything back, and she goes, "Awesome." So that's how they meet. And it's a violent movie about kindness, is how I like to describe it.
Right, cool. Because there are obviously elements of, when I watched it, there's Network in there. There's Taxi Driver. From my mind, there was even Mike Judge's Idiocracy. Was that an influence at all? No, or was that just,
you know what's funny? The other ones were, but you know, I've seen Idiocracy, and it gets compared to it sometimes. I'm not sure about the comparison. I like that movie, but is it just because of the dumbing down? Is that what it is?
Idiocracy is more about where society's going, which is horrifying, and you're aware.
And this is right now. And this is the first time I've written a screenplay that's supposed to take place now. You know, the other movies, I don't know where they are or what time, or you know, damn cell phones, because if it was up to me, they wouldn't be in the movies I make, because I like movies that you don't know. So you watch them 20 years, and you know, movies like Dog Day Afternoon still holds up, and a lot of the movies that did influence us, like Badlands and Bonnie and Clyde, obviously. Some movies that people bring up that I actually really didn't care for it, and that's Falling Down, because it's kind of racist. It's this guy who's, you know, I don't think people understand. He really wants to go to his daughter's birthday party, and people won't let him. I don't care, you know. And Natural Born Killers is of course a fascinating movie, but that movie blames the media and also it explores our ghoulish interest in murderers. But this movie, if it works for people, is trying to explore why are we so interested in constantly being distracted. We non-conversations or non-versations, as my wife likes to call them. And what's funny that I'm here, because honestly, one of the tipping points was I was watching they had a My Super Sweet 16 marathon here in London the last time I was here, and I was like, oh, these children should die.
Before you'd written the script, or
was kind of helped motivate me to write the screenplay,
because I read another interview with you where you said it wasn't necessarily a laundry list. Frank is not you. I mean, you share some of the same.
Yeah, I would say I agree with about 90% of Frank's.
That's the homicidal part,
10%. The shooting strangers in the face part is where I draw the line.
But what was it about Joel that made you think, this guy can play a homicidal maniac?
Well, I mean, he's my friend and I've known him for a million years, but he it was. him on Mad Men, you know, he played a guy who's not getting laughs, but still riveting, you know, and I think that was it, you know. But I had back surgery and I was high on Dilaudid and had sent him the script, but I forgot to tell him that I wanted him to be the lead. And he's like, "Which
I'm the little girl."
Yeah, yeah. He's I don't see me as a perky 15-year-old, but he he's like, "Which the guy in the office?" I go, "No, Frank, I guess the guy," you know. Plus, you know, Joel's directed stuff, so it really was like having another set of eyes on the set at all times. It was great. You
I
know?
Think he fulfills the same function in this film as Robin Williams did in World's Greatest Dad.
Yeah,
he's a guy, he's doing really, really bad things on screen, but he's got this innate likability that makes you go all the way with him.
Yeah, this weird empathy, you know, those two both have it where even, yeah, exactly what you're saying, even though they're doing horrible things, you're still kind of concerned about them. You know,
yeah, I call that the George Costanza effect, where you go, "That's horrible, don't do that," also, "I'm loving this."
Yeah, I don't understand how or what it is that certain folks can get away with it and you do that, you know what I'm saying?
Would you mind if I did a little bit of triple fact checking here, because I've written pieces about you before, which sounds a bit odd, but it's true. And I found a quote from Martin Scorsese, who said...
That's a good one to straighten out.
No, I want to straighten this out, because it sounds like too good a quote, and I mean that in a kind of twisted way, but the quote is, "Shakes the Clown is the Citizen Kane of alcoholic clown movies."
Right.
What is the truth behind that?
The truth is that that quote came from the Boston Globe. It was a woman named Betsy Sherman, and she wrote that. The Citizen Kane of alcoholic clown movie, Shakes the Clown. Years later, someone was interviewing Martin Scorsese, and they said, "You really think we should preserve every movie?" And he goes, "Yeah, yeah." He goes, "You would preserve Shakes the Clown?" And he goes, "I love Shakes the Clown." And he goes, "You love Shakes the Clown?" And he goes, "That's a very dark, dark place, that world." And then, and the guy goes, "Yeah, it's a clown movie for Citizen Kane fans," or something like that, the reporter does. And Scorsese goes, "No, it's the Citizen Kane of alcoholic clown movies. Get it right." And so technically he did say that, but he's not. Yeah. So and I remember just reading that quote, and my daughter's like, "Dad, why do you keep reading that?" I go, "Your dad's never going to win an award. You know, the fact that he knows I'm alive, this is insane, you know."
Have you ever met him since?
No, but I have had friends who've gone into auditions and stuff, and they'll go, were you in Chase the Clown? Serious.
He's a walk-in IMDb. I mean, he's phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. And I think we've got to let you go in a second.
Oh, that's all right. We can go a little longer now. Let's see. What's the other questions?
You've referred to your time, your early career, as your porn star days, your porn past.
A little bit, yeah.
And I enjoyed that, and I was just wondering whether you still feel that way, because I read that in interview from a few years ago.
Right.
Have you grown accustomed to your back catalogue?
Not really. I mean, it's not like it's just this weird past that I have that it doesn't bother me. I'm not like, "Please don't bring up Hot to Trot," or "Please don't bring up Police Academy. He's got to leave." It's just this really, you know, I just read a quote roughly about that same thing, and it was like, I Virginia Madsen was in Hot to Trot with me, this talking horse movie. It's a terrible movie. and I see her, and I go, "Hey, how are you?" And she's like, "Hey, how are you?" Okay. And she was kind of cold. And I was like, she was very friendly when we made the movie. What's the deal? And then I thought, it really was like a porn. It was like, "Hey, remember we were in Ass Blasters 2 together? Remember?" but she, you know, so I figured that's why it's like that. You know,
porn stars don't tend to have people come up the street and quote lines back at them. Maybe they do. I don't know.
Maybe they do. Well, yeah. They're just like my lines in movies. They're like, maybe. Yeah.
Does it rile you then when you still get people quoting Police Academy stuff back?
No. It doesn't rile me, but it's also, you know, if I had met these people at a wedding, the first thing they would say is, "Hey, remember that wedding we met at?" You know, so I treat it like that. But you know, I never think that age is an excuse for anything. But I did those movies when I was like 23, 22. You know, so I did. I took those jobs the same time most of my friends were just getting out of college and university. So, unfortunately, my first job, you know, plays cable television every couple months, you know. So, but, you know, boo-hoo, you know. Yeah. As my wife would say, oh, your diamond shoes are too tight. Oh, people recognize me from inferior projects. Wah.
But there's been all this talk about a Police Academy reboot now. A completely hypothetical situation here. I know you like to do your own stuff, but if a studio came to you and said, big paycheck,
would you write it and direct it? I think that'd be hysterical. They would never do that. You know, I mean, the first day, you know, Gutenberg would get shot in the first thing. I think I heard they're going to reboot it and they're going to do it like 21 Jump Street. They're going to make it a comedy this time.
Yeah.
You've got me there.
Now with jokes.
Now with yeah. But
so you weren't a fan of the first one when you signed on for it?
I hadn't even seen the first one.
Okay.
I know people probably don't believe that, but
it was a big formative experience for me as a
yeah, was it? Kid, yeah. But it also had breasts. And then they That's got rid. Then they got rid of the breasts. Then they
it just became PG by the end.
Yeah. Then they just became I don't know why they really screwed the formula, and they kept adding more and more comedians. Isn't that weird? Did you notice that? There's just like more and more casts. Like it was like a cast of 50 or something.
I recently read Steve Gutenberg's memoir.
The Gutenberg bio?
Yeah.
And how is it?
It's like, it's fun and very like unenjoyable. He's very light about it. And he says that making the Police Academy films was just incredibly pleasurable. He just says it was just a lot of fun. It was very, you know, silly.
Then he must have left out me crapping in his trailer. Because I used to torment that guy so bad. He'd be like, hey man, because they give him a big trailer. Hey man, my trailer's your trailer. And then I go, oh, is it? And sometimes I'd just be nude in his bed when he'd get come down from the set.
I also read that you and Joel Murray once stole John Cusack's credit card.
That's true. We would, when we were doing this movie One Crazy Summer, we would take his credit card numbers down and order things from, like, you know, bamboo steamers and I don't know the equivalent, you know, just all this late night 80s commercials.
So all the stuff that was kind of fuel in a way for God Bless America was already on TV.
No, it'd be like these crappy, like, you know, Freedom Rock. It'd be like an album full of like 70s hits or
featuring the
exactly sort of you know Ginsu Knives, you know, any kind of crap late at night
we'd arrive at his store.
I would order it and he's like, you guys didn't get a set of bamboo steamers? You know, bamboo steamers sound way dirtier than
you weren't tempted to, like, you know, put a Porsche on there and
well, no, but it was Joel that pointed that out to me recently. Because you remember taking Cusack's card? I was like, oh, dude, no.
Did you pick the name God Bless America so that when people looked up the song, it would also say not to be confused with God Bless America film?
And no, that's
two
great.
People are going to click.
That's great. But you know, when I go on the road, you know, I'm like in some country station in the South and they're like, God Bless America, what's that movie about? And he's like, it's a patriotic salute to the troops, you know, cause there's no way I'm going to get out of here alive, you know?
Well, let me tell you.
Yeah. It's like, you like America? Yeah. That's how I like the sound of that. Actually, I was at a gun store cause when we got ready for the movie, the guy goes, what's the movie called? I was like, God Bless America. He's like, that sounds good. You know, it's got my $7.
I'll take two.
You know, when I was writing this screenplay, I would be Googling weapons and all this stuff. And you know how, like, your computer eventually it starts giving you banners.
Suggestions, yeah.
Suggestions, yeah. I'm not kidding. It said, visit Arkansas. It was like a holiday package to Arkansas that came up. Well, because I was looking at guns so much, I guess.
I've just got a couple of things. I just want to talk about the film again really, really quickly. But out of all the things in the film, and God bless you, by the way, for including people who talk and text during films.
Yeah,
in your list of pet hates.
That is my kryptonite.
I was good. Yeah, which one is your biggest pet hate?
I would say that actually really. I mean that's how I pick a movie by how I go. Well, it's been out has it been out long enough that the morons will have already seen it? You know, oh, maybe I'll go at noon. And, you know, what I mean? You have to like figure out how you're going to avoid those people.
You have to go tactical, yeah.
Well, as a comedian, you know, you're on stage and I look out and there's just glowing crotches. You know what I mean? It's like, it looks like a Kiss Me Deadly or Pulp Fiction suitcase. You know, everyone's crotches is blue or white or gold.
Well, listen, Bobcat, it's been a pleasure.
And, thanks. Thanks, guys. Thank you so much.
Excellent stuff there from Bobcat Goldthwait. And there's a name you'd like to say 10 times fast in a hurry, my word. And let's start actually with God Bless America, which is already out, is already on release, and it's a movie I liked a great deal, but I also like, I like all his stuff so far as the director. I haven't seen Shag's a Clown, I'll be completely honest, but I do want to seek it out because Martin Scorsese likes it.
And World's Greatest Dad was terrific as well. Yeah. It was a really dark, clever comedy. So,
yeah, and this is very much along the same lines. Yeah. It kind of, it could have been another super, which is that, for my money anyway, absolutely dreadful James Gunn, Rainn Wilson superhero vigilante comedy from last year, which was just turgid and horrible to sit through, and had unlikable characters doing terrible things. And this has characters doing terrible things, but like World's Greatest Dad, in which Robin Williams covers up his son's suicide and basically.
Well, he doesn't actually
stages
cover
his
up
son's death.
He turns his son's horrible, stupid death into something poetic. Right?
Into something poetic, which then furthers his writing career, which he's been trying to get off the ground for ages and can't, and suddenly he becomes a flavor of the month and everyone. So it exposes, that film exposes hypocrisy in terms of people's relationship to each other, like, oh, someone they ignore or actively bully, but in death they claim to have loved and been great friends with, and this movie kind of, it doesn't quite have the same narrow laser point vision of aiming for his targets, but what it does do is it has this broad scattergun, almost blunderbuss approach to American society. So at the beginning of the film, Joel Murray, who is very, very likable and grounds the movie because he perpetrates some horrendously violent acts in this movie, but you're kind of with him all the way, which is a very, very nice piece of work on Goldthwait's part to do that. He's basically flipping through American TV shows, and it's effectively the dawn of the end of Western civilization. It's just there on TV. So it's like horrible game shows. You got American Idol type shows. You got dreadful My Sweet 16 MTV shows with scatterbrained people yelling because they didn't get the car they wanted. Mm.
I've seen My Super Sweet 16. Can I just interject here? That is a show that will genuinely make you fear for the world.
Yeah.
If you ever get the chance to see it, it's scarier than most horror movies. Anyway, sorry, do go
on. Why is it scary?
My Super Sweet 16 is about incredibly spoiled, incredibly rich teenagers demanding things of their incredibly indulgent parents. And
it's
genuinely horrific. It is people basically whining because they got the wrong model Mercedes for their 16th birthday. It's that kind of show.
Does it make you want to go out on a killing spree?
A little bit, yeah, but so far I've resisted.
Okay. So what's the... I mean, you mentioned it's satirising. It's a satire.
Mm-hmm.
What is it satirising? Is it satirising kind of a natural born killer? Is it satirising media's approach to violence or America, Americana, small town America?
It's satirising a bit of that, a bit of the media's approach to violence, because as they go in this killing spree, the media just almost totally ignores it. I'm not entirely sure why, but it's also about, I think, the decline of American civilization and the fact that people don't talk to each other anymore and they just demand things and they're just empty headed and materialistic, and it's a very angry movie, but it's also a very, very funny movie at times and very thoughtful. Yeah, it's not quite the movie that you think it is. You think it's going to be just filled with hyper-violence and a very broad movie, but it's actually quite subtle, and it stops an awful lot for philosophical exchanges between Joel Murray, who again is excellent, and Tara Lynn Barr, who's a 16-year-old girl who joins him on his killing spree. They become almost this Bonnie and Clyde type figure. But I think if you... it's interesting. There's going to be something in this movie, I think, that hits a nerve with certain people, whether it's the way that TV shows like American Idol exploit people who just want to be on TV, mercilessly exploit them, and shows like TMZ, which or websites like TMZ, which in the States just hideously invade people's privacy, or even just something as simple as people talking in cinemas and texting and phones, and it's about that sort of the fact that people are so closed off now. They don't care. They have no consideration for others. They don't care about what they do or how my actions affect you. And so there's going to be something here that you kind of connect with and resonate with. And it's actually quite disturbing when you watch people shooting someone in the cinema for texting. You're kind of going, I can kind of get on board with that. I can see that. So it's quite a disturbing film. It makes you reflect upon yourself.
Does anybody replace anybody's shampoo with glue?
No, but
and
maybe
get punished.
Who knows if there's a sequel? Who knows? Maybe in that one. But I would recommend that one. I think it's also out very, very soon on DVD. It's also on demand very, very soon. But if you can go see it at the cinema, hell, why not? So now we're going to move on to a film that I suspect is seared onto Helen's brain.
Why would you say that?
Well, because it's true, isn't it? Yeah.
We'll discuss it.
A little bit, okay. It's Magic Mike, the abtastic Steven Soderbergh movie that stars Channing Tatum as a male stripper. It's based on Tatum's own experiences and his own muscles to boot, and also stars Matthew McConaughey, Alex Pettifer, Matt Bomer, and Joe Manganiello in a display of six-packs that will seriously dent the self-esteem of anyone with a flabby gut. Okay, Helen, this movie's gone down well with, in the States, but given that it's Soderbergh, it's about so much more than just a parade of flesh, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's actually one of the most likeable and kind of fun movies I think we've seen all year. And I don't think it's just for the straight ladies and the gay gentlemen, to be perfectly honest. I do think this is a kind of across-the-boards film. I have to say I kind of had a tendency to sort of cover up my eyes and mutter, oh God, we don't need to see that, during the bits involving thongs and thrusting. And I'm sure I'm not alone in the cinema in that. But it's mostly
really?
Played for laugh. Genuinely, I don't need to see that much. You know, there's a certain level that it's pleasant to look at, and then there's a certain level that you're just like, oh, put it away.
Okay.
So, yeah. But, it's not the whole film. A lot of those stripping scenes are played for laughs, and they're very, very, very funny. Mm. And the rest of the film is just really charming. It's you know, a very likable, freewheeling kind of a story. Channing Tatum is really good in this. He's not just stripping in the evenings. He's also trying to work during the day. He's roofing. He's trying to get his own company off the ground. He's kind of struggling to do so. He takes Alex Pettifer under his wing as a new stripper and is trying to show him the ropes. Meets Alex Pettifer's sister, played by Cody Horn, who is he has a bit of an interest in. And there's all this sort of machinations at the club going on in the background. Matthew McConaughey, who's the boss of the club, is trying to open a new branch, move them all down there. So there's kind of a lot going on, but it doesn't feel scattergun. It doesn't feel unfocused. It just feels like a kind of a really interesting slice of life about this weird little subculture that most of us have no experience of. I mean, obviously, Chris, you've been a male stripper in your time.
Yes.
So, you know, you'd know more about it. But
the blob,
generally
they call
speaking,
me.
I've been a paint stripper.
Well, close enough.
I love the fact, though, that this is a Steven Soderbergh movie.
Yeah.
I just love Steven Soderbergh. It's just like there's nothing he can't or won't do, you know.
Mm.
Yeah. He shot a movie with a porn star, you know. He shot Haywire, which I actually, you know,
yeah,
really enjoyed,
yeah,
as an action film, as an action thriller. You know, he even did a, you know, Michael Curtis-style 1940s film. And now
less
he's
successfully,
sort of,
but yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, less successfully. I love the fact that it exists.
Yeah.
I didn't like
yeah.
the film.
Absolutely.
You know, I remember when Erin Brockovich came out, I thought, what is he doing? What's going on here? And this is just kind of like,
this is
again,
actually Erin Brockovich-like, I think, in some ways.
Yeah.
In that it's kind of, in some ways, a quite traditional story. It's you know, the basic plot, the basic outline is something that we have seen before, but usually it's kind of maybe been done the other way around. I mean, we've kind of seen the Erin Brockovich story before, but it was generally a man's story. This, to
was
the
it?
Extent that it's been done before, has generally been a woman's story.
I see what you mean. I see what you mean.
And he's just kind of slightly tweaking it and playing with it. And it feels like a movie with a director that's having really good fun, but also a director who's very good, which I think helps.
It makes a difference for this kind of film to have a pair of, you know, a pair of hands, a pair of eyes behind it, like his. I think, you know, that's what elevates it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. And I think also it's got a great cast. You know, the fact that he was involved means that you get, you know, the Matthew McConaughey's and people to play relatively small roles, but give them a little bit more kind of weight, I guess. And and yes, I just said that Matthew McConaughey gave a role weight. Go figure. He's having a moment.
It's all going on for him at the moment, isn't it, McConaughey?
Yeah, he's kicking off properly.
Yeah.
Now is the time to get Reign of Fire 2 off the ground.
Come on.
Yes. He should use this newfound clout.
So it's very much not show guys, but I am interested in, like, you know, because there is a kitsch element to it, I suppose, as well.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in, like, what sort of a lifespan it will have beyond this, because they've already got a musical lined up, presumably subtitled Turn on the Night again. That could be fun. I mean, it's going to be one of these films that just lives, I think, isn't it?
I think
it feels
so
that way already.
Much, yeah, it really does. I would go back and see it in a moment. I was actually at a mini hen do last week, and I was trying to persuade the mini hens that we should go and watch this as a...
Right. I thought they would have been on their list.
Well, for some reason, they thought it'd be more sociable not to sit in a cinema for 2 hours and watch a film, but hey, go figure.
What did they do instead? I'm almost afraid to ask.
Learn to make cocktails. But no, it's just, honestly, this is one of the most likeable and kind of joyful films I've seen this year, in a strange way. And I would thoroughly watch it again.
One for the O'Hara top 10?
Of the year, so far, certainly, yeah. It's not, you know, top three, but it's definitely in there.
The second sexiest Matthew McConaughey movie of the month.
Oh, goodness, no.
Any fried chicken in this one?
No, nobody eats anything fried in this movie.
I can't imagine they do.
No.
Having seen the stills.
I don't think they've ever eaten a carb, actually.
What the hell is Joe Manganiello doing? I mean, that body's just stupid. Stupid. Your
Isn't
body is stupid, man. No, but I'm angry about it. Whereas you're like, ooh, and I'm like, come on.
He is... like, he's basically scene stealing throughout this film. Like, he doesn't have a scene where it's all about him. He doesn't particularly have his own subplot happening. He doesn't have any real focus on him. What he does have is an astonishing ability to steal scenes from people all around him. And there's one bit where he's in the foreground and Matthew and Channing Tatum and Alex Pettifer are talking in the background, which will have you actually fall off your seat laughing. I'm not going to say what he's doing, but it's really quite wrong. If you've seen Austin Powers, it's that bit.
Ah, yes. What, the second one?
The first one.
Oh, actually, no, they repeat it, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Okay, all right, okay. I think I know what you're talking about. So he gets frozen in time and... Okay. we're going to talk about a re-release, because we covered it in great depth this month in a magazine. It's Paul Verhoeven's 1990 sci-fi classic Total Recall, in which Arnold Schwarzenegger gets his ass to Mars, as we all know. So, Dan, does it hold up?
Yes, it does, actually.
Well done. Let's move on to Ice Age.
It's funny. It's funny coming back to it and having rewatched it in tandem with the other Verhoeven sci-fis, Starship Troopers and RoboCop. I'm not including Hollow Man, and neither would he.
poor old Hollow Man.
Yeah, no, really not poor old Hollow Man.
Poor Hollow
Man. That's a terrible film. Anyway, and I, it's interesting the parallels it has to those movies. I mean, we were talking, you and I, Chris, were talking about it quite a lot, about the you know, we actually put together that Verhoeven diagram of the things that overlap, not just people who are in it, but just the themes and the satire
motifs and
it's interesting just coming back, because, you know, when I first encountered Total Recall, it was just like awesome action movie with great sci-fi elements to it, and it was just fine, and I'm coming back to it now looking at it and just going, it's really funny. It's so much more a comedy than I appreciated originally, and as I say, that's how it fits with RoboCop, which at heart is a comedy, and Starship Troopers, which at heart is a comedy. So and it's just, you know, it's the way that Verhoeven, obviously this, because it's based on the We Can Remember It For You Wholesale Philip K. Dick short story,
which is a great title, by the way, for a story. I just love it.
It's brilliant but of course, you know, there were hundreds of attempts to adapt this, and, you know, stacks and stacks of drafts to try and make it work. And I love the way that when Verhoeven came on board, Schwarzenegger was already on board. Schwarzenegger wanted him, and Verhoeven just went, well, Arnold changes it. He changes what it is. He makes it funny.
Yeah.
And he does.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's just like, this guy's preposterous. Look at him. You know, he's huge. What's he doing? and it just becomes this weird, mad, larger than life, you know, the exploding woman's head moment. That's just, you know, that's really funny.
Yeah.
You know, I was more distracted by how good the special effects were when I first saw it.
Yeah.
Now I'm looking at it just going, this is just daft. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger in a dress throwing an exploding head at people.
I think it's aged that way. I don't remember it feeling, maybe it's because I was sort of young when I saw it. I've got this, I fished out this old, this August 1990 copy of Empire. I remember buying this issue with Arnie's Total Recall character on the front. Because Arnie kicks haste. Yeah, kicks ass. It's also got a solidarity feature on location in Poland, which probably appeals to me as well. I'll read that later. I remember this issue. I remember being so excited about this film. I remember the trailer. I remember how amazing it looked. Mm. Now looking back, you're right. You feel like Paul Verhoeven was kind of like just a little ahead of his time with the subversive humour. It's interesting that David Cronenberg was originally working on making, bringing this to the screen. He had, I think, William Hurt in mind, which is the weirdest kind of recasting to go from William Hurt to Arnie.
I guess,
absolutely. I mean, he talks about how, you know, he'd taken it to the studio and they'd said, well, you've just made the Philip K. Dick version and we don't really want that. We want a sort of a straight up, you know, action film. But you're right, he smuggles in the subversive comedy in all his films, and you feel that now really strongly.
I do find it fascinating how some of the most successful Philip K. Dick adaptations have nothing to do almost with the Philip K. Dick story. You basically take
where is a Scanner Darkly?
You take the premise and you just build something insane around it, and it seems to work remarkably well in a way that it's hard to imagine with anybody else, with any other writer ever, really. I mean, I love A Scanner Darkly, as it happens. I love The Adjustment Bureau, which is closer to something that Dick actually wrote. But I have to say, I mean, something like Total Recall, which just, you know, throws out 90% at least of the story, is, you know,
but it's a great plot. It's a great plot as well. The kind of the second guessing and the undercurrent that it's actually, none of it's actually really happening kind of thing, which was the first time I'd seen that when I watched it for the first time.
Yeah.
If you see what I'm saying. I'm not saying no one else has ever done it. It's been done since and it's been done before. But at the time, you know, in terms of, I was the target audience for that, a teenage boy.
Well, given
that
you're such a big fan of Brazil, I would have thought.
Yeah,
have you seen Brazil before?
I saw Brazil after I saw Total Recall.
Well, there you go.
But there are similarities, certainly. It's just kind of like, you know, that whole, you know, if I'm not me, then who the hell am I, you know, and his former self appearing on a video screen and talking to him and first of all being his mate.
Yes.
His accomplice, and then of course being no. I want my body. I want back. I want my mind back. I want my body back.
What's interesting to me about watching it again, I saw it recently, is how obvious it is that the whole thing's a dream, and an implanted memory, or you know, it's his experience at recall. It's what he gets implanted to him in recall that actually happens.
Yeah, the entire plot is told to us very early on.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
Guy, the car salesman style guy, just sits there and just basically tells you the plot.
Tells you the plot of the film, and then even when he's about to be implanted at recall, the guy says off camera, "Oh, Blue Sky Mars, that's a new one."
Yeah.
And you know, he sees the Rachel Ticketing character appear on screen before he goes under, so it's abundantly obvious. But when I first saw it when I was a kid, all I cared about was the violence and see you at the party, Richter, and the one-liners and stuff. It's an incredibly layered film.
Mutant Mary,
indeed, absolutely. Who's interviewed in this one's Empire?
She is indeed. Thank you for mentioning that. As is Bixby Snyder, which
yes,
from RoboCop. I should
buy that for a dollar.
Yeah.
So it is still utterly fantastic.
And it's the last kind of pre-CGI blockbuster almost. Because I think T2 followed in footsteps. This film has less than a minute of
next year,
CGI
actually.
In it. That amazing X-ray sequence.
Yeah.
But a lot of prosthetic model work, etc. I think it looks great.
It's Rob Bottin, isn't it? In this one. Rob Bottin did a lot of the effects work, the prosthetics.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Yes, he did. But yeah, I think at the time it was the most expensive movie.
Yeah, Schwarzenegger regularly did that. Then he was, and T2 took that.
And then True Lies after that.
Yeah. True Lies after that. Yeah. So. Very, very interesting.
Big man, big budget.
Absolutely. Okay, so now we're going to discuss two of next week's biggest releases, Ice Age 4, Continental Drift, and Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, in which Keira Knightley and Steve Carell bond against the backdrop of the apocalypse. Let's start with a really depressing one, shall we? Ice Age 4. Now, this series is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the most successful animated series of all time, beyond Toy Story movies, beyond Shrek, and beyond, yes, even Madagascar.
It's weirdly successful from my point of view. I've never quite understood the appeal. Having said that, I think it's aimed at people a lot younger than me.
Yeah.
And for them, it seems to work brilliantly.
My kids love it.
There you go. And I think this one is exactly more of the same. You know, the cast has expanded yet further. This time, rather confusingly, now, you may be under the impression that the animals featured in this movie lived before the last ice age and went extinct about 10,000 years ago, and therefore this was set around about that time. But of course, you would be completely wrong, because this one features continental drift, which happened hundreds of millions of years ago. So something in the fossil record's gone horribly wrong, or they're travelling back in time.
Helen, there were dinosaurs in the last one.
Yeah, but that was like an Arthur Conan Doyle kind of, you know, little closed off world. I was prepared to go with that. This one upset me.
See, they're really smart, though, because the last one, I mean, obviously the first ice age worked well because it's whatever, it's talking animals, but different. And then the second one built on that. The third one, what do kids love? Dinosaurs. There's been dinosaurs in it. This one, what do kids love?
Pirates.
Pirates.
You don't need continental drift to have pirates. I'm just saying.
No, but anyway, the iceberg is the pirate ship.
Yeah, but there's also continental drift involved, not just drifting.
Yeah, but they need a reason to get to sea.
What are they going to have in the next one?
I'm just saying.
Bankers.
There was actually
is that what you always liked as a kid?
Bankers.
Yeah.
Says a lot.
Of course.
Says
yeah,
a lot.
Nice. Does
there was actually a suggestion that they'd all get frozen and they'd wake up in the present day in a museum or something. You can just see that happening for five. But honestly, I mean, the characters, I guess, likeable. They've got this huge kind of supporting cast around them now. They've all got sort of family units, which gives them a lot to work with in terms of characters. And an insane voice cast. Absolutely insane levels of stardom among people who only say like two lines.
Such as
Drake and Nicki Minaj, who literally have about two lines each.
Hang on a second, I'm just going to Google them.
Peter Dinklage. Peter Dinklage is the
Peter Dinklage is the big bad, yes.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Lopez.
Drake
is in
was
there
a gladiator, Chris. Just
for all these things.
That's right. Because they had to get a lady mammoth in the second one, didn't they?
Yes.
Although there was a lady sloth briefly. Now they have to have a lady saber-toothed tiger.
That's right.
There's a baby mammoth, so I'm assuming they're going to need a baby saber-toothed tiger.
Well, she's no longer a baby mammoth. She's now a teenage mammoth, so you get all of those wonderful teenage tropes in here as well. She's having, you know, arguments with her father. No, that's mean. Listen, it's fine. It's an Ice Age movie. You know exactly what you're getting. The animation's actually very good. I still don't love the character design, but that's just me. Yeah. But it's exactly to the level of the others.
How much screen time does that little funny scrat filler get?
Quite a bit, and he's quite funny, and he gets a really nice payoff at the end of the movie.
Yeah. I really liked it.
There's a lady scrat in the... That's it. So it goes lady mammoth, lady scrat, lady saber-toothed tiger.
Yeah.
We gave it 3 stars.
I believe so, yes.
So that's...
It's a recommendation. If you like the Ice Age films, yeah, this is absolutely...
It might surprise you. Madagascar 3, which isn't out in this country yet, but is out in the States, I really, really liked. So who knows?
Juice Bigelow.
This is true. I do like Juice Bigelow.
European Gigolo.
European Gigolo. Let's move on then to Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. Helen, you loved this one, didn't
you? I really
did.
It's honestly one of my top films so far this year in terms of kind of emotional impact. I'm not saying it's perfect, because there's a bit in the middle where it goes into kind of slightly generic road trip territory. Mm. But I thought it was just really, really clever stuff. So the idea is that, you know, an asteroid is headed our way, and the space shuttle containing presumably Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck has actually exploded on its way to intercept this asteroid. So we're all definitely doomed. And that's basically the beginning of the film. Okay. We're all definitely doomed. And it's going to be a matter of weeks.
Oh.
And so the first thing you see is...
Quick, Chris, buy that Galactus.
I'll be right back.
So the first thing you see is Steve Carell's wife listening to this in their stopped car on one side of the road on the news, and then just getting out of the car and running away from him. And he's sort of left on his own. And, you know, it's kind of... What are people doing? So people are still kind of going into work, and he works for an insurance company, and he's answering the phones, and as you may have seen in the trailer, people are calling up asking about, you know, disaster insurance and Armageddon policies, and he's saying, well, yes, but the policy, you know, the costs are high. Which, if you think about it, is really weird. And at the same time, he's kind of, you know, trying to figure out something to do, and people are reacting in all sorts of different ways. Some people are, you know, running around like mad idiots. People are hiring hitmen to kill them because they can't bear the certainty of facing death in a number of weeks, so they'd rather face the uncertainty of facing death at any moment.
So this is a certain death asteroid.
This is a certain death, killers. Absolutely planet killer. Everybody's gone. Goodbye. Thank you for playing.
All right. Okay. And yeah. And Steve Carell then teams up with Keira Knightley to stop it.
Keira Knightley lives downstairs. Yes. Spoiler. No, Keira Knightley lives downstairs. She's very upset because she's missed the last flight home to England. And they become sort of tentatively friends, I guess, and sort of go off looking for Steve Carell's lost love about a third of the way into the movie. And I don't know, it's really emotional. It's very smart, just because it kind of feels, you know, as bizarre and strange and crazy as human beings are faced with, you know, something so awful.
Is this a bit of a trend now, this comedies about the end of the world? Is it because there's one going into production, isn't there?
There is. I think that one's a very different one. That's more like Apocalypse is in the Devil. The Jay Baruchel and Seth Rogen.
Yeah, right. This is a film called The End of the World, which is currently shooting and stars Jonah Hill, Seth Rogen, Emma Watson, James Franco as themselves having a party in the Hollywood mansion while The End of the World goes on outside.
I mean, is this something pertinent about our times? About the zeitgeist, if I may use the word.
You may.
This kind of, because it's not just comedies as well. There seem to be, you know, all these takes on the end of the world. There was Another Earth,
We know how it's going, I guess.
Melancholia, and then Abel Ferrara is making a film. He's made a film with Willem Dafoe called Last Days of the Earth, and. Seems to be on people's mind, and a lot of it as well are planets and comets smashing into the Earth. And my theory, and I don't know whether I've expanded on this in the podcast before, apologies if I have, my theory is that this is actually happening, and this is the government's way of preparing us to cope when the news actually breaks.
Well, that's a massive
time. Lo-fi indie romance.
I'll be honest, I hope I cope as well as Steve Carell does, because I thought he was utterly flawless
in this
film.
Does he cope by essentially being Steve Carell and being awesome?
He is awesome, absolutely. He doesn't cope by being sort of Rick Tamlin Steve Carell The Office Steve Carell. I think he copes by being, you know, lovely, delightful, low-key Steve Carell.
Movie Steve Carell.
Little Miss Sunshine Steve Carell.
Yeah.
Yes, something closer to Little Miss Sunshine Steve Carell, but perhaps a little bit less morose than that even.
Who's more surprising in the film, Knightley or Carell?
Keira Knightley I thought was good, but she's got a little bit of an edge of that manic pixie dream girl character to her.
I mean who's further away from their sort of traditional kind of, if they have a traditional ballpark?
To be honest, I think that neither of them's massively stretched in that sense. They're both very, very good though. But also I should mention the supporting cast keeps throwing up really, really good performers.
I'm not even going to mention who's going to
turn up, but every time, you know, pull into a service station at the side of the road, and there'll be, you
Johnny
know,
Depp
interesting things happening there. Not Johnny Depp, but really just good comedy faces and names that you'll know.
The one thing that worries me about this movie is, as good as you make it sound, isn't it innately depressing just by its very nature? I mean, not to I haven't seen the film, I don't want to necessarily go into spoiler territory, but this doesn't sound like the sort of film where Steve Carell is suddenly going to strap on a rocket pack and divert the asteroid using his bare hands.
I don't want to get into spoiler territory either. I didn't come out depressed. I came out wanting to hug people a little bit. It's a little bit like that.
Like Magic Mike.
And yeah, well, that was maybe not hugging. Anyway.
Oh, my word. This is an NC-17 rated podcast, and we're moving straight on.
Well, I just meant, you know.
Yes.
Would you describe it as.
What?
Would you describe it as mellow collier?
First one, we're doing that one all day.
I kind of would, actually. Honestly, I came out of this with a friend who immediately called up her best friend, who she'd had an argument with several weeks before and hadn't spoken to since, and they made up and are speaking again, and it was all because of this film.
That is beautiful.
Isn't that gorgeous?
That
so
is
go and see it, and you know, forget all your old vendettas.
Also out this week, it's a decent Willem Dafoe thriller, The Hunter. There's two anthology films, 7 Days and a Half Anna, which features a segment directed by Benicio Del Toro, no less. And there's also The Players. I flip you for real. And The Players, which marks the first time we'll have seen Shaun de Chardin. Do you have an impression of Shaun de Chardin, Dan? Do you want to share with us?
Yes.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
That's really good. So we're going to be the first time we've seen him on the big screen since he won the Oscar for The Artist. So there you go, you can watch that. And then there's Katy Perry, Part of Me, the 3D concert film about the singer, which I guess essentially is Magic Mike for blokes. And that is well, it exists.
In 3D.
Don't forget to join us next week for more geek-related film fun. But right now, all that remains for us is to thank you for listening and say goodbye to Helen.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye to Dan.
Farewell.
Say goodbye to Phil.
Ciao.
And goodbye from me. Goodbye.